Wrestling Radio. I'm Hotshot Danny Duggan, and after a long hiatus, I am back on EWR to discuss all the happenings in Canadian Wrestling's Elite, and there's many of them coming up on the horizon. And later in this episode, we're going to have a man 30 years involved with Canadian professional wrestling, Marty Goldstein, on the line to talk his big, long history in Canadian professional wrestling. But first, on deck this Saturday, Morden, Manitoba, Canadian Wrestling Elite returns to the Morden Block Party for the second year in a row. What's the Morden Block Party, you ask? It's a fun, live, interactive, two-hour, free outdoor event in downtown Morden, a part of their street festival. A lot of different happenings and going-ons going on this Saturday, and Canadian Wrestling Elite can be a part of the fun from 1 to 3 p.m., and we're coming in with a stacked show. We've got a huge six-man tag main event on deck in Morden this Saturday. The Canadian Crusher, AJ Sanchez, teams with the German juggernaut Moses Luke and the blue-eyed idol Tyler Colton to take on the team of the Zombie Hunter Mentolo, fresh off winning the Elite Eight tournament. And in his corner will be former CWE Tag Team Champion, the Murder City Saint Nate Hardy, and the first All-Star Brian Rich. All those men will also compete in action earlier in the day, as Mentolo will take on AJ Sanchez in a battle of two former CWE champions. Also on deck, the first All-Star Brian Rich versus the Mastermind Kevin Cannon. The Murder City Saint Nate Hardy takes on the blue-eyed idol Tyler Colton. Corey Kincaid, the Super Friend, goes one-on-one with former two-time Open Rules champion, the German juggernaut Moses Luke. And local wrestling favorite, Psycho Sidney Manson, will be in the house taking on brand new CWE Tag Team Champion in his second reign as CWE Tag Team Champion, the Misfit Mike Mission. This all goes down 1 to 3 p.m. this Saturday in Morden, Manitoba. If you've been living under a rock, it's the only way you're going to not know what's going on next for Canadian Wrestling's Elite, and that's June 27th in what's going to be one of the biggest shows in the history of CWE. WWE Hall of Fame inductee, fresh off the 2014 class, Lita makes her Canadian Wrestling Elite debut on Friday, June 27th in Winnipeg, Manitoba at the Holy Cross Gymnasium Hall. She's going to be a part of a very special autograph session from 5:30 to 7 p.m. where she'll be available for autographs and photo opportunities. And then later that night, she's going to make a special appearance on the CWE live event itself. So stay tuned to CWECanada.ca and CWE TV over the coming weeks for announcements regarding that event and Lita's involvement on that event. Before we go into the June 27th event, we're going to get ready for action. The guys are going to get geared up and ready to go in preparation for the big event, Twist of Fate, on June 27th, with an event at Rookie Sports Bar, Transcona, June 20th. We return to what's becoming quite the popular bar venue for CWE when we present the Bad Boys of Summer. All the stars of Canadian Wrestling's Elite will be on hand Friday, June 20th, with a special 8:30 p.m. bell time for this 18-plus event that will feature all the stars of CWE. This week, Canadian Wrestling's Elite returns to television on NAC TV this Friday at 9:30 and on Sunday on WCG TV with a big episode. The masterpiece, Chris Masters, goes one-on-one with local wrestling legend, beautiful Bobby J. For all your latest news, go to CWECanada.ca because some big matches are going to be coming up the pike for not only Rookie Sports Bar, but the Twist of Fate event coming up. And then shortly after, our big 10-show in 11-day tour spanning the month of July. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to get Dr. Marty Goldstein on the line to talk professional wrestling.
Actually, stick with us. Danny, the producer, Kid Remington here. Two quick questions, just because you were away when we wrapped up the last Action Hero tour. Can you quickly take a minute and talk about working with Chris Hero on the tour and how that all went down for you?
Most definitely. Chris Hero has to be one of the best imports we've had in recent memory, if not ever, in Canadian Wrestling's Elite. He has a reputation of being one of the best wrestlers in professional wrestling. In every media interview I did across the province, they said, tell us about Chris Hero. Because, you know, he hasn't been on that big stage of WWE Raw or WrestleMania or SmackDown. And I told him, you're getting the very best professional wrestler on the planet today. He's the hottest free agent in professional wrestling. You may not have heard his name yet, and if you haven't, you're definitely going to remember it if you come to one of those towns and see him live and in action. He definitely delivered, lived up to the hype in every sense of the word. He was here for six shows in 6 days, and he gave us six incredible matches, actually seven incredible incredible matches, because he wrestled two in Winnipeg, seven incredible matches over the span of 6 days across Manitoba, and each and every town got to bear witness to some incredible professional wrestling, definitely some of the best wrestling some of those towns have ever seen, and some of the best wrestling CWE has ever produced, and that's saying something with a lot of the top talent that has come through here.
Right on. And one last question. You're talking about all the media. You got to take part of, in a special challenge match with that DJ out from Western Manitoba. How did that match go?
Well, it went great for me, not so great for him. RJ Lilly had a rough go at his first attempt at professional wrestling. We did battle in Souris, Manitoba. It was a very short-lived affair. I don't think he was able to mount any offense on me other than the free headlock I gave him, and even that didn't work out so well for him. We got into the ring, we got ready to go, and sadly, you know, I'm a nice guy. I don't like to do wrong to others. He kind of brought it on himself, and it made matters worse. He brought his mother out to the event. He got his whole family there, and they were all sitting front row, eager to see what RJ could pull off in his professional wrestling debut. So I had to beat up a grown man in front of his mother. I apologized throughout the duration of the match for doing so, and I think she may have forgiven me and understood, but RJ Lilly had to probably take a couple days off work after that one, if not a whole week.
Well, RJ Lilly, you know what? Props to you, because you had your professional wrestling debut and your retirement match all in the same night. And, you know, at least we've got a guy like Marty Goldstein on the show today who's had a little longer career than that.
It's kind of funny because, as you're going to hear when we get Marty Goldstein on the line, that's actually how he made his professional wrestling debut. He went from being a color commentator to getting thrown in the ring for some action. So this has happened over the span of 30 years in professional wrestling, and I'm sure it'll happen again. So if anyone out there wants to step in line and get ready to give professional wrestling a shot, if they don't think what we do is legitimate, there's a long line of wrestlers I'll take you up on that offer.
And we are back on the line, and on the line is a mainstay of Canadian professional wrestling. Welcome to the show, Marty Goldstein.
Thank you very much, Danny. It's a pleasure to finally be able to juggle our schedules so I can make an appearance, and I made a commitment already to you that I'll come on again when we have more time to get a little deeper into some of the topics you want to cover with me, and I look forward to the opportunity.
We've been trying to get you on the program for a long time now. You're a controversial figure in professional wrestling. Everyone's got an opinion on Marty Goldstein.
Well, you'd know better than me, but if you say so.
So for those not familiar with yourself, because you're not always in front of the camera, you're not always in front of the live audience, tell us about Marty Goldstein and his history in professional wrestling.
Well, essentially, I'm in a state of blissful retirement, except for the odd article I might write when somebody passes away for slam wrestling. I was a fan from when I was probably 5 years old, and at the time, the only wrestling in the Winnipeg market, and I realize I'm going to sound like a dinosaur, but the only wrestling in the Winnipeg market was on CJAY on the CTV station, and it was the Vancouver tape. So I grew up watching Donnelly O'Jonathan and Gene Kaniski, the Tolis brothers, the Assassins. There was a really great era in Vancouver wrestling that kind of spoiled me to some extent for what, you know, I thought wrestling was and could be. There are very few people that saw Thulu the Butcher when he was not so big. There are not a lot of people that saw Dr. Jerry Graham, Tony Bourne, Patty Barrett, Tex McKenzie, Haystack Calhoun, Stan Stasiak. I saw all of those guys on the Vancouver show. I wasn't even aware that there was any other kind of wrestling until I was in, like, I guess grade two or grade three. And some of the other kids had been taken to an AWA show at, I assume, the auditorium. And I found out that there was a whole other world of wrestling. It was sort of like American League Baseball, National League Baseball. And then I started to watch the KCND feed of the AWA show every week, with the antennas on the rooftops back in that era, and putting tinfoil on the rabbit ears to improve the reception, and was pretty darn hooked. There was a brief period of time I didn't watch wrestling. Around the time, around 75 or so, when Bockwinkel first took the title off Bern Gagne, I wasn't watching it too closely then, but that was about a year and a half period maybe where I didn't watch it too closely. But other than that, I followed it the whole time. And then my mom's hairdresser was Vince DeLuca. And Vince was, of course, a longtime running mate of Tony Candelo's. And I started doing sports casting coming out of, right out of high school with what was then CJUM, the U of M radio station. Chepchuk had gotten his gotten clearance to go on. It was actually Cablevision, East of the Red, and they needed somebody to do play-by-play. So Vince took me down to Chalmers, introduced me to Walter. I went to the Winnipeg Tribune and suggested a story to Donna Harvey, who was then the editor, about this whole idea of me having a wrestling match, you know, the announcer having a wrestling match against the top dog, as it were, and them running the article. Donna Harvey was a wonderful journalist and very generous to think that she would just sit down with a guy with very few credentials and took me into her office at the Tribune and loved the idea, brought Buzz Curry in to talk to me about it. It was going to go in there, a special section they ran, I guess, on the weekends. And so we shot the, I did TV, and this was when Kay Van Broda was a young man, Chris Pepper, Scotty Lightfoot. Pepper was still under hood in those days. Walter was, of course, the top heel. This was even before Dave Petro broke in. This was in 1980. And my first match was, I think it was June 16th or June 18th, 1980. And although technically I won by disqualification, it was only because Walter Shevchuk beat me to within an inch of my life. And I peed blood for 2 weeks because he slammed me on the floor a couple of times.
So how did you transition from play-by-play into professional wrestling? What was the angle that put that together?
The angle was Walter had a handicap match against Broda and Lightfoot, I guess, and the ref had gotten injured in the previous match, whatever it was. He, you know, took a bump or something. And so I left the broadcast booth to referee the match, and Walter shoved me. I disqualified him. He, I don't know if he popped me one or chucked me or whatever. And then he cut a promo, and then I cut a promo, and then he threatened to unleash an unholy holocaust upon the announcer, and that was the angle that led up to the actual match. And at the time, I was in the cast of Guys and Dolls at Rainbow Stage, and so this was a very interesting and really before its time crossover between somebody in the entertainment business, as it were. It's not like I was a major player or anything, and you know, crossing the Rubicon into the realm of getting into the ring. It was not too common back in those days. Very rare indeed, and I was beyond lucky that I was able to get into the business in that way. I had just gotten, there's a whole story behind what happened with the article. I got the article finished in August of 1980, got married. I wouldn't say we had any kind of a honeymoon, but we got married on August 25th, and August 27th or 28th, the Tribune folded. So the article never ran. I took all those bumps for nothing, and I found out only a couple of years ago from somebody who had been at the Tribune that the way they had set it up at the time was there was a representative of the company that bought it out or whatever, or some sort of official, not somebody from the newspaper. And people would come in and they'd say, they'd negotiate severance or whatever, get paid for articles. Well, I didn't know that because apparently I could have walked in, told them, yeah, I was promised $500. They would have cut me a check on the spot. So I proved I was a real mark by not even thinking about how do I get my money out of the deal, even if it wasn't published.
To give people an idea on how things have changed over the last 30 years, what kind of preparation and training went into this one-off match with Walter?
It was rare for its time in that it was highly choreographed, in that Walter laid out, he liked me because I understood the game, even if I wasn't physically, trained. And I was a very, believe it or not, I was a reasonably athletic kid. More athletic than a lot of the guys on his crew. He really wanted me to wrestle full-time, which was not, I didn't see that happening. And especially just getting married and having a kid already, it seemed to be a very unlikely kind of scenario. But it was very choreographed in that there was, you know, the match was laid out with like five specific spots, and that's what it was going to be. It was a great idea until I reversed the whip on him. He hit the corner, and the top turnbuckle came off. And I had never seen that. I'd never seen that happen at any AWA shows I'd gone to. I'd never seen that on TV ever. So I stood there like, now what? Well, Walter cleverly rolled behind me, immediately hit me with an enormous and half-shoot nut shot. Down I went. He clamped on the figure four. He made sure to maneuver so I was in the ropes. He gets DQ'd, and now I'm holding my crotch. My ankles are hammered from being slammed on the floor because I didn't know how to take that properly, and my kidneys are bruised from being slammed on the floor. It was I would, you know, it was the greatest experience of my life. What do you want me to tell you, Danny?
So the match is all finished up. Did you go back to the play-by-play booth, or did you start to venture into a little bit more wrestling or on-air appearances?
No, honestly, what happened was I my agreement with Walter was just to go through that cycle of matches. I wanted to approach it more like a business, and he wasn't really prepared to do that with his promotion at the time. It was very much a throw-together. New Grand Wrestling was a great experience, but it was very much a thrown-together kind of product. And very shortly thereafter, I moved. My then wife was a teacher, got a job on a Northern Reserve, and so we moved away. And then about a year later, I was talking with Walter, and he wanted to improve on what was going on with his play-by-play, and we were moving back to the city anyway, so I actually went to work for Walter for a period of time, and then did other things, and then ended up back on his payroll again in 1980, late 83, early 84, for another 4 or 5 months, until New Brand folded, which was May, I think, 17th of 1984. So the plan wasn't for me to stay doing play-by-play full-time, but when I came back in October of 82, I did his TV all the way through to the end in May of 84, the runs with Leo Burke and Johnny Weaver, and then he brought in George Wells.
So how long did you work for Walter before moving on to another promoter?
Well, there was no moving on to another promoter, really, because Walter folded. You know, there was an intense rivalry, and this was not a good-natured rivalry, between Tony Condello and Walter Shevchuk. And there was, you know, guys moving back and forth, the Jones brothers and stuff like that. Nobody was really going to draw a dime. But there was, the earliest era of people phoning the hall to, you know, try to submarine somebody else's show and stuff. And just to let you know, it wasn't just Walter and Tony or whoever going back and forth, because Vern Gagne did the same thing to Walter in, I think, Kenora, called the RCMP, because God forbid we would have Lars Anderson or some American working without a permit or some bullshit, right? So it was a different era completely, because there was no such thing as competition. It was viewed as opposition. Anytime you ran a show, if you ran a show and there was some other promoter who thought he had rights to the territory, like divine right, it was a war. It was not you run your business and I run mine. Very, very different era. I mean, really, New Brand Wrestling was very possibly, outside of the Bear Man, the last of the Canadian outlaws.
You mentioned calling the RCMP for Lars Anderson not having a work permit. Things like that are very common in Manitoba professional wrestling, or have been in the last 10, 15 years, of the amount of promotions that have popped up. What were some of the other tactics that were going on at the time between the promoters to try to put each other out of business?
Oh, the typical stuff that you probably experienced, Danny, and I'm sure, Andrew and Wayne and every other promoter's gone through in this territory, go to a hall and say you'll run for free, fake complaints, go to the show and guys will go to the show and start to, try to stir up trouble to, disrupt the show a little bit or sour the audience. There were a few things where I think, how should I put this, unique to the era, old school tricks. But, one of the favorites was calling the commission, of course, and Walter did not run with a permit from the commission, and he took the perspective that because the wrestlers were not being paid, this is like semi-pro hockey. And Walter was a hockey player, and a very good one, and is still one of the leading power skating coaches and developmental coaches in Manitoba. But again, with Walter Shevchuk, he's not part of the establishment. He's like an outsider. So Walter challenged the commission, and I'm trying to remember if it was the commissioner, was Herbin Buldanaya, or if it was... can't remember the name of the guy that was after him, after Herb, and they realized that they were kind of stuck, that if they charged him and it went to court and the answer was, well, these aren't professionals, these are amateurs, if nobody's making money on it, then there was a real fear that the act would collapse. So they left Walter alone, and they kept pressuring him, and finally, because he was growing in popularity, New Brand was growing in popularity, and getting booked all over the province because of the TV show, when we got on CKY, which was then still CJY, when we got on CTV, Walter decided it was just easier to put up the $500 for the bond, and that way they basically wouldn't bother him, and frankly, they didn't, because he wasn't the typical kind of, so, you know, what Tony would call local yokel. Walter had smarts, and he had business smarts, and the whole origin of me fighting commissions was rooted in what I learned watching Walter, you know, how Walter dealt with them. I never liked a commission that did something useful. It protected the fans, protected the wrestlers, would have been fine, and what we had was a commission that would put their hands out and expect 12 free tickets, and then anytime Vern Gagne sneezed, they would catch a cold. And that's what was going on in this territory. It was incredible. Walter brought in Lars Anderson. And there's a lot of history that, as I think I mentioned to you online briefly yesterday, Danny, there's a lot of history of the wrestling business, especially in Canada, from, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, through the early 90s, which really, unfortunately, encompasses almost my whole career, that is not really well-founded online. There's not a lot of tape available. The articles haven't been uploaded to... uploaded anywhere. There's not a lot. Nobody had VHS machines. There's like no video remaining of the odd time that there'd be a news story about the business. And so there's a lot of stuff that was lost. When Walter brought in Lars Anderson, which is in and of itself a hilarious story, well, that scared the shit out of Vern Gagne, because Lars was running TV out of Duluth, where I think he was living at the time. And Lars, and I still have the list. He hand wrote a list for me. He had like 25 or so TV stations stretching across North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wyoming, Montana. He might have had a couple other places. And Lars had a low red product. It was the original World League Wrestling, the name that Harley Race uses in Missouri. The original World League Wrestling was actually Lars's. And it actually made the magazines at one point, in the territorial ratings. WLW actually made the ratings one time. It was actually got a column space. So Lars was viewed as a threat because Lars had become a big national star off of the early days of WTCG. Was it Turner Broadcasting before it became TBS? So Lars and the Anderson brothers was one of the big stars on cable TV. And, of course, they would throw that feed up for free. They would let any cable provider in North America pick up their feed. So the next, you know, you've got a potential audience of 50 million people. What was happening was in a lot of the remote towns, and again, Manitoba would have been like Flin Flon or the Par, Thompson, they'd put up a community satellite, and they'd wire it to the houses in the community on their own. And so Walter would bring in Lars and roll into, like, the Par or Flin Flon or some other towns. And they're drawing like 700, 800, 1,000 people. Because people knew, first they knew who Lars Anderson was from the AWA days. And here he is coming to your town with his fake junkyard dog and his Tommy Rich knockoff. And a couple other, he had some workers actually were not bad. Anton Rojak, I think, was on his crew as well. And Steve the Kid Collins. Steve Collins worked Hawaii and Florida and stuff later on. And so it drew, and it scared the hell out of Vern Gagne. He was scared. Vern was scared any time anybody could drop 400 or 500 or 600 people, because you're drawing a decent number of people, you're making money at that rate, and the ticket prices are less than the AWA's. So, Vern was forever complaining, good way to put it.
So,
to use a stronger term.
So with all this political warfare between promotions, what prompted you to start your own office in the late 80s?
Well, now, let's see. In 19, what happened was the territory was essentially dead from when Walter folded. I mean, when I say there might have been the odd spot show, I don't think Tony ran anything. I don't think West 4, if I'm remembering correctly, folded, had itself folded. Tony had stopped operating. He might have done, like, northern tours or, you know, the odd town, you know, Carmen or something. But there was no wrestling in Winnipeg from 84, half past 84, till 86. And then Tony, I want to make clear, Tony and I are very good friends, and there's a lot of history, and a lot of it's very positive history between Tony and I. And he's been a tremendous help to me in the last, really, 15 years in a lot of respects. And he puts me over, and I put him over, and there's good reasons for that happening. But at the time, he hated my guts because I was Walter's right-hand boy, right? I mean, the first time I met Tony Condello, he came to the dressing room when he tried to get in. I happened to be walking in. This is Chalmers. And I, like, sort of cut him off, and I go, excuse me, that's fucking here to see fucking Walter. I go, who are you? Tony fucking Candela. Just wait right here, Mr. Candela. I wouldn't let him in the locker room. I go into the dressing room, I'm like, Doug McCall is there, and I don't know, Mike Stone, Broda, whoever. I go, Walter, there's some guy named Tony outside that thought he was just going to walk into the locker room. So Tony hated me, like, right from the first minute he met me, right? Anyways, Tony got on CKY, and in his own remembrances in the interview he did with you, I listened to a goodly portion of it. His memory isn't what it used to be, let's say, and there's some things he maybe just wouldn't recall because it wasn't his part of the business, but it was mine. We got on CTV before him. We were the first local audience, to get, local promotion, to get on commercial television. Walter and I were the producers of that show. It was called All Canadian Pro Wrestling, and they slotted us right after, I think it was right after the Vancouver tape, the All-Star Wrestling out of Vancouver. Then Tony got on TV in 86. There's the odd spot show that Ernie Rowe would do, like in, out by where Cheech grew up, you know, where Cheech was born, like in Hartney, and he'd do the odd spot show. We did a show in Hartney in 80, was it 87, 88? We did a spot show out there. That was the first time I basically had the book and was given the run of an entire show. And it spun off of that experience. I had gone to Kansas City to do color commentary for Bob Geigel, took a 24-hour red-eye bus, 24 hours and 10 minutes from Kansas City to Winnipeg fans. And then on the Sunday, I guess it was, we drove out to Hartney and did a show and turned Brian Jewell heel on Cheech. And I got to work with Doug McCall. No, it wasn't McCall. It was Walter couldn't make it. I actually had to don the tights. So there was 8 years between matches for me. And I potatoed the hell out of Cheech, but he was so green, he potatoed the hell out of me, too. And it was sort of born off of that, where I saw, okay, I know how to put a show together. Between me and Dave Pinsky, brought David into the business, really, in 86. One of the spot shows he refereed, and he did some ring announcing. There's one spot show at Norwood that Ernie did with, Mark Charles and Cheech and Eddie Watts. I can't remember who the other guys were. Maybe his son, Mike Rowe. But there was no territory here, and you had a lot of good workers, and they couldn't come home and homestead. And this really, to me, what it revolved around is there was nothing here when a guy like Brian Jewell would come back from the Maritimes, or Rick Patterson would come back from Stampede, or if Mike Stone had gone on the road and come back, or Norm Austin, Killer Austin. There was no place for them to work in Winnipeg, and they weren't Tony's guys. You know, Tony had his own cronies, and he had guys who were loyal to him, and by and large, we were essentially either Ernie's boys or Walter's boys. And so that is what was the impetus behind my wanting to run. And Tony did not take too kindly to it, to try to use the commission. One of the funny angles, try to complain to the commission that the commission had a policy, an unwritten policy at the time, that you couldn't have two wrestling shows on the same night. So Tony's got one show booked, I don't even know where it was, like Swan River or something. And I'm booked in Barron's River, Poplar River, Barron's River, Poplar River, Blood Vein, did this two-show tour. And he tried to convince the commission that he couldn't allow me to run. And Buck Matiowski phoned me, and I told him, how does this work for anybody when I'm wrestling 400 miles away and I'm using a totally different crew of guys? So it's not like, you know, the quality wrestlers won't be there on each show. It's, if anything, this is good for the wrestlers because it ups the payoffs. Because now there's a little bit of competition between the promoters. Tony hated that because I paid my guys well. For that era, they got over, you know, the point of view was, and even the illustrious Bulldog Bob Brown, when I met him, the first thing out of his mouth was about the fact that I had run. I found out from Scales that he had been going around the locker room talking about how I had paid guys too much, at which point Mike Shaw and Don Morocco come seeking me out during the intermission trying to get booked. Tony just, he wasn't paying what I thought guys deserved. His style of promoting was a different style than what I saw would attract an audience. There wasn't the concept then of marketing and whatever. I was more a forerunner of the kind of promoting, Danny, that you do, that Andrew does. They didn't really look at it that way. They didn't care if there was something spelled wrong on a poster. And I mean, like, serious, like, grammatical errors. And, like, well, if you look like an illiterate on your poster, you're not going to attract an audience. You're not going to attract sponsors. It's got to be done professionally. And I tried to bring that. Dave Pinsky was beside me the whole way. And I tried to bring that attitude forward. And I tried, my philosophy was never to use a wrestler who wasn't as good as me. And I didn't see myself as being, frankly, very good. Apparently, I was better than I thought at the time. But we tried to put on shows that had story, you know, good stories, and that had, a good, like a lot of action to them. And of course, with me, the interviews, the whole layout of the show in terms of the dramatic arc, it was always very important. And that's something that was less important to Tony, and frankly, less important to Walter too. There's a lot of stuff I wanted Walter to do on TV that he just didn't want to do because it was not. He didn't think it required that kind of effort, and I always believe in putting a lot of effort into the product, and you'd be rewarded at the gate, and you'd be rewarded with support from the business community.
So who
essentially what got me started was Tony wasn't running and wasn't a hospitable environment for a lot of the guys. And my idea was, you know, if you only run 4 months of the year, you run it sort of seasonally or something as opposed to year round. Well, when the guys are off, you're bringing back a guy from a territory, and maybe you have some tape to use up to promote it a little bit, and it would have been good for everybody, in my opinion.
So it's definitely a lot of work to go from booking a show or wrestling a show to running a show. Can you please explain the process that it took to get up and running in the Winnipeg market? Who'd you contact to be a part of your crew? And what were some of the things done by Tony to try to offset what you were doing? You mentioned him calling the commission and things of that nature, but I imagine there's a little bit more to the story?
No, you know, that was more so that when I did the first run, the Can-Am Wrestling run in March of 89, I guess it was, He did try that one trick with the commission, and quite honestly, he laid off in terms of anything active because all I did was the one tour. What happened was we did the tour, and then in September of '89, a kickboxing show couldn't get permitted or something and canceled on very short notice. But the ring was already paid for. So Ernie Rowe had the ring booked for St. Cloud. And he and Mike Stone came to see me. This was a convoluted story. I had left town and gone on the road with Tim Flowers and Mike Wazanski for the summer of 1989. I had just come back to Winnipeg, and they came to me to where I was staying and said, the ring's there, we can run a show. And I'm going, it's like 13 days advance notice. Okay, but I want this and that and the other thing. And I really wanted it run my way. And Ernie was amenable to it because Ernie Rowe was all about giving the boys a chance. And then I took the tape of that St. Cloud show, and that was the infamous Caveman Broda babyface turn show. He didn't really turn. We just booked him as a babyface, and thank God it worked. And we booked Cheech. Cheech wanted to work against Mark Charles, his old longtime friend and tag team partner. So that was the first time Cheech worked as a heel. We had Broda against Killer Austin. The feature singles belt was Stone under the hood as the American Destroyer against Brian Jewell, and they beat the hell out of each other. And the opener, Sluggo Smith, good old Sluggo, didn't feel he was ready to actually get in the ring and do an opener with Doug McCall. And so Doug was one of my dearest and closest friends, because he did play-by-play for Walter before I came back, and we were together, we were inseparable for years, and I ended up having to don the tights do an opener against McCall, and then we cut the video together, and there was the first of the infamous Battle Royals that I used to book, and then Pinsky worked on the play-by-play with me, and that was Curtis Breslau's debut as well with that show in St. Cloud. And we took the tape, and I cut a pilot together, and I used the pilot to book shows in community centers, and also it pitched to MTN, where I had started working as a legislative reporter. And in January of 1990, or before January of 1990, I decided I was going to take the plunge and start promoting, booked the show at the West Community Center based on the strength of the tape. You know, they saw the kids cheering for Caveman Broda, and the kids all hit the ring when he won the Battle Royal, and it looked great, right? So they booked the show. Well, of course, that's Bob Brown's neighborhood, and the illustrious Bulldog caught when there was opposition in his own neighborhood, went ballistic. And the next thing you know, I get a letter from the commission claiming that we were breaking the law by advertising the show ahead of time and would require this and that and the other thing, and they sent me a bunch of rules that included a line of credit and three letters of reference and a $10,000 bond. And this is, of course, blatantly false, totally illegal, unheard of, but that had the effect of, well, the commission's on top of it, the boys are, don't want to jeopardize their ability to work for Tony or whatever. By no means am I suggesting Tony had any part in that. And the Filament government didn't give two shits. They didn't care that the market was being left to the WWF. I was about trying to give employment. You know, the Can-Am format would have brought in wrestlers, teams from Minneapolis or Kansas City or whatever. But the idea was to give employment to Canadian wrestlers and create Canadian stars. And I had talked, had long conversations with Jack Laskin in California, with George Cannon in Windsor, Ontario. I sought the advice of the old-time Jewish wrestlers and promoters about what philosophically should be done. And the commission didn't care because they were getting 12 free tickets to meet Hulk Hogan. They did not give two shits about the Canadian wrestlers at all. And finally, Glenn Dawkins, the Winnipeg Sun, Scott Taylor wrote a column about it, and then Glenn Dawkins at the Sun picked up on the story, recognized when I showed him, you know, what happened was the rules were in the what's called the Gazette, the Manitoba Gazette, the official publication of notices or whatever. And somebody had taken whiteout and changed the fucking rules. So this is like, Danny, if you're going to start promoting and there's a commission here and you get a piece of paper and something's typed in a different typeface, bigger typeface, and it's an enormous amount of money for you to open your business. So I'm looking at this like, okay, either these people are crooks or maybe they're anti-Semites, and I frankly believe it was a combination of both. And it took a while to get any media attention because the conservative government certainly didn't care about small-town wrestling. But once it hit the newspapers, I have to regress. Walter decided after what I went through, he wanted to start promoting in the fall of 1990 maybe. And he came to me and said, Martin, I'm going to start up again. I said, well, Walter, do me a favor. If you're going to get a bond with the commission, just give them $500. Because that's the legal amount. They were asking me for $1,000, but for a $10,000 line of credit. So Walter sends them a check for $500. They send the check back, and they threaten to charge him. And they go to the newspaper and threaten and say that they're going to charge him. Ran an illegal wrestling show at the Concord or something. So I show Glenn Dawkins. I go, well, this is some kind of extortion racket because here's a copy of the Gazette, and it says the bond is $500, and here's the check they returned for $500. Well, this ended up with the provincial auditor being called in, and among other things, it determined, as I had figured out from looking over the paperwork closely beforehand, nobody wanted to listen, the commission had overcharged the local representative of Vern Gagne, who was Don Britton at the time, the vice president of Global TV. He overcharged them. Instead of charging 1% on the gate, which was the legal amount, they charged 3%, and this is in Hulk Hogan's heyday. So the commission pocketed an extra $70,000. Off the AWA in its heyday.
Wow.
And refused to refund the money, which is just a phenomenal arrogance. And, you know, they use the money to live high off the hog. They're going to boxing commission conferences in, like, South America and whatever other bullshit they were doing. And it was the wrestlers' money. Because the boys were, in those days, were paid on a percentage of the gate. This is money that could have gone to the wrestlers. And instead was making, you know, Buck Maniowski and his other bum-licking cronies a bunch of big shots.
So
I challenged that. The commission moved in. Walter ran for quite a while without a permit because he'd given them the check for the right amount of money. They refused. It's how are they going to charge him and win in court? It was a bizarre period of time. And I want to tell you, Danny, none of that would have happened if it was today. Because with the internet, the commission would have been humiliated in 48 hours. It's so different now, and it's better for guys like you and other promoters in that if you were to get fucked over by a commission, government is held much more accountable now. They can't keep things secret because you just scan the document, you put it online, and 10,000 or 30,000 people see, my God, they used whiteout to change the law.
So did you drag the AWA into it? Did you inform them that they were being ripped off of that amount of money? Did they get involved in the war with the commission?
Well, actually, what happened was Dan Denton had come back to town from Mexico City when some of this was breaking. And he looked over some of the paperwork and saw saw that from the audit came out and proved that the AWA had been ripped off. And he said, Martin, you should phone them and, you know, tell them that you'll work on recovery for a percentage. Now, their representative at the time this happened was not Bob Holliday, who was a big commission supporter and not the sharpest pencil in the drawer in many respects. So the promoter that held the permit at the time was called Brinko Sports, which was Don Brinton. So I contacted Don Brinton, who by that time had been relocated to either Vancouver or Victoria to work for Global TV out there as a vice president. His daughter was a lawyer, and she looked over the paperwork I sent them and agreed that I was right. They had actually withheld Don's bond all those years, and when he stopped promoting for the AWA, they had never refunded it to him. And so I recovered his bond with interest and got a piece of that action. Actually, a sizable piece of the action on that one. There's a lot of money that's been saved up because of the interest rates at the time. I have a letter somewhere in my own files from Don Brinton telling the commission panicked. And I can't remember if it was Holliday. I think Holliday phoned Brinton and tried to tell him this guy is starting up trouble here and blah, blah, blah. And he didn't know. I guess Holliday didn't know. I'd already talked with Don. And Don basically asked him, how could this have happened if you were supposed to be watching out for me? What were you doing to why are you defending them, ripping me off? And I had a very good relationship with Don Brinton and was very thankful for the opportunity to represent him. But again, in the end, you know, I think that a recovery motion or a recovery action would have been successful when a government collects fees from a law that has not been properly passed. But he, at that stage of his life, it wasn't worth it. He wasn't a wrestling guy. He was a TV guy. He didn't feel it was going to be worth it. And then he was concerned that if he did that, what if Wally Carbo decides he wants a piece of that action somehow or whatever, right? So he didn't pursue it legally, but there was recovery, and I did get paid by Don Brinton. I saw the photocopy of the check, and it was good money in those days, the work I did to recover the bond for him.
Well, I think
he was the only one ripped off. Tony, that's where Tony ended up really changing his mind about me in a lot of respects, because I was right. I told him he'd been ripped off, and he didn't believe me. Anytime he ran, and it was between one and he was being charged 3%, it should have been one, he got beat too.
So everybody ended up saving money once this came out.
Well, no, by then, they didn't save money because by then they ended up legally hiking the fee to 3%. But the era of the commission being all-powerful was over. They weren't going to be able to bully anybody around anymore. And then they tried it one more time with the new legislation in 1995. And by then, you know, the boys realized that they could appear. It wasn't just promoters that are affected, the boys. And I went with, I know that Pinsky and McCall met with the commission, and I met with the commission with Gene Swan, and it was commission of government representative who was, you know, in discussions about the bill. And this was like straight out of Ontario. No man, no weapons at ringside. No oil could be applied by the wrestler. No chokeholds. No this. No that. They claimed they wanted to do testing, and I said, okay. Well, the first thing is when you don't test Hulk Hogan, we're going to take you to court. So the first thing is say goodbye to kiss Hulk Hogan goodbye. The second thing is now you're going to tell Mr. Fuji he can't use his cane. You go up to Mr. Fuji and tell him you can't use your cane. Oh, and they wanted to appoint the refs, so they wanted to like shoot referees. And I told them, I said, you know, the commission wanted the power to stop a bout. I said, if you get up on my apron and you try to get involved in a match when it's going on and you get on the apron, believe me, nobody's going to know whether you're the commissioner or some jackass from Cook's Creek. You're going to get popped in the mouth because the wrestlers are going to protect themselves. So if you want to take that risk, you get up on my apron. And Swan told them too, you know, Gene Swan, the fact that there's no more commission, the role of Swan, and I believe Bastien also, as well as Dave and Doug, it was the boys, more so than the promoters, it was the boys that explained to the government representatives, including, there was one guy who was an assistant to the sports minister at the time, was Jim Ernst. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He's a Jewish guy. Was it David Leibel or something? And he actually came to one of the shows and sat with the boys after upstairs in the room, me and Cheech and Mark Charles and whoever else and Doug. And he understood, you know, that it is what it is, and it wasn't what it maybe supposedly was in the 30s and 40s when the commissions were part of the kayfabe. and it was because of the boys there's no commission. Now, that did make things better for better for everybody and opened the door to a lot of characters maybe that should never have had access to a ring. But be that as it may, I maintain the business is better off without a commission that can shut somebody down because they're getting greased by somebody or some promoter, you know, starts spreading false stories about another promoter. I think it's been far better off in terms of the development of talent because there's been more opportunity for guys to get into the game. There are a lot of guys that you've wrestled with, Danny, and frankly, guys you've booked, and no offense to them in terms of their level of talent or their dedication to the craft, but it was such a controlled industry. A lot of you guys would never have gotten into the business. There would have been no business for you to get into because the commission would have controlled who got a license to promote. And at that point, you know, it's a matter of who can suck dick the best. And I didn't believe in that. I saw it as a business and not as something that should be controlled by a bunch of... Howard Cosell had the best comment about boxing commissions, and of course, boxing commissions, in most cases in that era, are also regulated wrestling. A bunch of two-bit hacks. Government appointees who've never accomplished anything athletically or otherwise a day in their life. And Cosell hated commissions. And I was with Howard Cosell on that one.
We're barely out of the 80s, but we are out of time. We're going to have you back on the program in a couple weeks because I think we've got a whole lot to still get through here in the journey of Marty Goldstein in professional wrestling. I think there's still a lot to the story of the commission we haven't got to yet, so we're going to have to save that for another time and really give people an in-depth perspective on how you helped shape and change professional wrestling for good here in the province of Manitoba.
I think, again, because there's not a lot of this information online and because of the nature of the era of when it occurred, you know, that period of history is glossed over. But guys like Shepchuk, who ran Outlaw and succeeded in a lot of markets for a couple of years. I mean, there's a lot of things Walter did that, you know, other promoters, including myself, wouldn't have approved of or wouldn't have done. And there's always, you know, the switches on main events and this and that. I didn't believe in treating fans like total marks, you know, like they were rubes. But Walter opened the door to a lot of guys to get in, and for any criticism that's launched about Walter and about Tony too, the fact is that Tony he challenged Ringania, and the problem Tony had was he didn't think anybody else should also challenge Ringania. You know what I mean? But they caught on to this whole commission bullshit after a while, and even Tony turned on them, and that was one of the best days of my life. Just to conclude, is after I came back here, 10 years ago from Los Angeles, and I was having lunch with Scott Taylor and I think it was Harold Buchwald, the esteemed late lawyer. And Tony happened to be at Earl's and walked past and, said hi to me. He was talking with Scott. And he said he was fucking right. I should have fucking listened to him. Marty was 100% fucking right on those fucking commissions. And Buchwald bust out laughing about this because I guess he was familiar that for a time I was a very unpopular character in wrestling circles. But I'm proud of what I've done. And I am never going to change my opinion that what was done was necessary for, again, CWE, PCW, for the other promotions that followed in this past 10, 15 years to flourish. None of it would have happened if it was under the control of a government-appointed commission of stooges. They didn't care about us. We cared about us. And that's why I try to be friends on good terms with as many of the boys. You're not going to be friends with everybody, but I'm proud that in this day and age, I'm in my twilight years as it is, and I don't want heat with anybody. I want to be able to do what I can to move careers along, to give people the kind of help and advice that they may require, and to make sure that everybody who's around the industry has a positive experience. And to me, getting rid of the commission, if that's my legacy, it's far from the worst thing I've ever done, though it may have been in some respects the least athletic thing I ever did. But I'm proud of it, and I'm proud that guys like, yourself and Andrew and Rob Stardom were able to follow in our footsteps, the footsteps of Walter and Tony and me and Dave Pinsky and Doug McCall, to be able to promote an open opportunity for so many guys who love wrestling and who love the business and who love getting in front of a crowd.
Perfect. Thank you very much for joining us on the program today. I'm going to be touching base with you very soon to get you back on, and we can continue this journey through and discuss, like you said, how you changed Manitoba professional wrestling for good.
I appreciate it, Danny, and my best regards to all of your listeners out there.
Perfect. We'll have you on the line soon.
Okay, have a good day.
That wraps up another edition of Elite Wrestling Radio. We'll be back next week with yet another edition of EWR.